I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to Radio Times. Yesterday, General Keith Alexander, the head of the National Security Agency, and James Clapper, the director of National Intelligence, mounted a vigorous defense of U.S. surveillance of millions of Europeans and world leaders' phone calls, including German Chancellor Angela Merkel. They were testifying before the House Intelligence Committee. That information came to light after several European newspapers published the allegations based on former NSA contractor Edward Snowden's leaked documents. Alexander said the collection of phone records in France, Spain, and Italy was done with the cooperation of European intelligence services. Clapper said there was nothing new about the U.S. spying on friendly foreign leaders or friendly foreign leaders spying on the United States. Joining us is David Sanger. He's chief Washington correspondent of the New York Times. His book, Confront and Conceal, Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power, just out in paperback. And David Sanger, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good to be with you.
Does the testimony from Alexander and Clapper yesterday, does that raise any questions about the outrage that we heard coming from European leaders?
Well, it did on part and not on the other. And you really have to separate out two different kinds of foreign collection. The first is the initial reports that came out a few weeks ago, and I was in Europe at the time, suggested that there had been the kind of monitoring that we've heard about here, where metadata, the information that would be on your telephone bill about who you called and how long the call went on and so forth, that was collected for both French and then later revealed Spanish citizens. And Alexander pushed back very hard on that and said that the report was incorrect, and he and James Clapper, the director of National Intelligence, suggested that a lot of that collection had actually been done by the local, meaning French and Spanish intelligence services, and then shared with the U.S. And they suggested that the documents that, the Snowden documents that were the basis of those stories had not been properly understood by the people who had written the stories. The area where they seemed to concede things had gone on was the tapping of Angela Merkel's phone, or at least the monitoring. We don't know how much of that was just metadata and how much was actual conversation, although when you look at the order that began in 2002, it would allow both.
Right.
And in that case, they said, look, this is what foreign intelligence services do. I mean, that this is what you hire us to do, which is monitor foreign leaders, even allied leaders, and try to divine their intentions.
But should we be surprised that there is cooperation between U.S. And European intelligence services, essentially what sounds like doing this, if not the same thing, very similar things?
Anybody who is surprised at the cooperation between U.S. and European intelligence services missed the Cold War.
When there was a lot of cooperation, right?
Right, and beyond, and into the age of terrorism and the huge amounts of cooperation. Even, I mean, just look at Germany alone. You know, Germany has had significant issues with Al-Qaeda in their midst. Obviously, there's been sharing on that. Germany is a very central player in the negotiations with Iran. There has been a lot of sharing on that. Confront and Conceal discusses Operation Olympic Games, which was, of course, the cyber effort to go undercut the Iranian nuclear enrichment program. The Germans were bit players, but important bit players in a key part of that operation. So, you know, it's the cooperation side of what these intelligences do is probably 90% of what they do. The spying on each other among the allies is probably more like 10%.
Well, and I want to pick up on all of that, but then when we hear about European leaders being outraged about the what the NSA is alleged to have done, they want to come to the United States, they want to talk to the president. Is that for public consumption in their own countries, do you think?
Much of it is, and much of it is for calculated negotiation gain, and I think, you know, some of it reflects the actual public outrage. I mean, the non-elites in these countries probably don't understand the degree to which this happens on all sides. The Germans are not particularly aggressive at monitoring in the United States, but the French are extremely aggressive, as are the Israelis and many other partners and allies. So a lot of this is, once it becomes public, those politicians have to respond to the outrage in their own countries. But what do they want? They want to gain some economic advantage, which would come from helping block Google and Microsoft and Yahoo and others who are going to be offering cloud services from picking up a huge number of customers in their countries by making the suggestion that these companies have been compromised by the NSA. They also want better agreements with the U.S. on intelligence sharing. Remember, the U.S. only does sort of full intelligence sharing and, by understanding, doesn't spy on what's known as the Five Eyes, the sort of English-speaking victors of World War II. That would be Britain, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and, of course, the U.S. The Germans would like an agreement very similar to that.
The idea is that you are our allies. We're not going to spy on you, but we'll share information that might be beneficial to you or to all of us?
Well, with the Five Eyes, they share and have an understanding not to spy on, right? With the non-Five Eyes, you know, which would include Israel and which would include Germany and many other countries, Turkey, and there's a lot of sharing that goes on,
right.
And there's a lot of spying that goes on. Now, the current uproar would make you think that at some point President Obama may have to make a choice, and that choice may well be between collecting on these countries and cooperating more with them, an issue made all the more complex as the world turns to the much harder problem of trying to come up with a common way to monitor malware coming across and stopping cyber attacks.
Let me ask you a bit, though, about James Clapper and also Keith Alexander, because I don't know if lie is exactly the right word or not, but they did testify before Congress, I believe earlier this year. Clapper admitted that he gave the least truthful answer when asked about metadata collection in this country. Keith Alexander basically said that the NSA does not hold data on U.S. citizens. Does that raise questions about the veracity of their testimony, even yesterday?
Well, when you have admitted that you misled Congress once, and that was the case of Clapper, not of Alexander, you would have to think that that certainly affects you for the future, and I wouldn't be surprised if that's the case. I think that General Clapper probably did his credibility in Congress some harm with that, and he seemed to acknowledge that by apologizing later on for doing that.
I'm curious about the fact that President Obama has admitted that he did not know the NSA was monitoring German Chancellor Angela Merkel's mobile phone. I think that raises a whole host of questions, but what do you make of that?
Well, I could imagine how an American president who gets the presidential daily brief, which is pretty much a distillation of analytical reports, might not see the backup data. It's harder to imagine that his aides, who do get the backup data every morning in a big binder, didn't have as much of a concept of it. The hard part is that as these issues became more and more ripe, both before and certainly after the Snowden revelations, that someone senior in the White House, maybe including the president, didn't say, hey, let's see a list of who we are conducting these operations on and consider the risks of exposure. And you know, to my mind, the most interesting thing is that the NSA did not appear to have a rigorous process in place, I'm sure they had some process in place, for considering the question of whether the risk of exposure and what would happen after that was greater than the benefit of what intel they were getting from these means.
I mean, it's interesting even hearing from the White House the present tense and the future tense, but not at least initially acknowledging that there was some monitoring of her phone call before these revelations came to light.
Right, and we don't know what form that monitoring took, but we do know that it started in 2002 when she was not chancellor. She was the leader of the Christian Democratic Party, and no one would have known, including her, that 3 years later she would end up running the country.
And, of course, you know, Germany's history with certainly in East Germany with the Stasi, I'm sure this, you know, the idea of even a local government or foreign government monitoring has some deep roots and some deep concerns there.
It does. And the monitoring, you know, is an issue that goes way back in German society because they're thinking about what happened during the first half of the century and the rise of the Nazi parties and pervasive surveillance. So privacy issues in Europe have always been a bigger issue than they have been in some ways in the United States. You could argue the U.S. is right now sort of catching up with Europe in that regard.
How about the president's, I don't know if it's a cell phone or a BlackBerry, I don't know what he uses.
He uses a BlackBerry.
A BlackBerry.
But, you have to wonder how much longer that, his own staff makes fun of him for it.
But we know this is a president that likes to be plugged in, and I'm assuming most presidents or chancellors around the world, they want to be plugged in as well.
Well, in the case of the president, you remember he fought very hard to hold on to his BlackBerry in 2009 when he came into office. And so the NSA came up with a heavily encrypted unit that was specially made and then also limited his contact list. So he only communicates with a small group of friends, family, and senior aides. And even those emails can't be forwarded. In other words, if the president sends an email to somebody on his list, it's very difficult to forward those. I don't know how much other leaders follow the same practices. I'm sure in some places they do, but as one senior former intelligence agency head said to me a few days ago, any leader who talks on an open cell phone or communicates on an unclassified email probably ought to have their head examined. And not because the U.S. would be looking at it, but because of so many others it could be.
And do we know what kind, how secure Angela Merkel's cell phone was? Do we know?
We don't. We know only these two facts. It appears that this was her personal cell phone, not a government-issued classified phone. Right. So that would be very easy to break into if that is the case. And we know that the other day when she was emerging from a meeting in Brussels, she waved a new cell phone at the press as if to suggest that she had just gotten a newly encrypted model and this should solve the problem.
Like,
a little late.
Right? but other, we're almost up in a break here, but the Brazilian leader also had her cell phone hacked, it seems, or at least was monitored.
Right. Look, why would you think that if it was Germany, it would be Germany alone? This issue has been live with Mexico, this issue has been live with Brazil, and I'm sure it's live with many other countries that we suspect but just don't know about yet.
And that's David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent of the New York Times. His book, Confront and Conceal Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power, just out in paperback. And he joins us in this first half of Radio Times. We talk about some of the revelations with the NSA, and we want to hear from you. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. What do you make of the news, these revelations? Give us a call. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the Krefeld School, a small progressive independent college preparatory school for grades 7 through 12. Offering a learner-friendly curriculum, experiential education, a strong arts program including glassblowing, and weekly community service. With the capstone program of graduation by exhibition, Krefeld strives to foster critically engaged citizens in a community of individuals. Located in Chestnut Hill, Krefeld is widely accessible via public transportation and school buses. Monthly open house dates and admissions details at krefeld.org.
It's not about the pings, it's not about the dings, and it's definitely not about the mugs. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Thank you for what a successful membership campaign is about, supporting a new service that has your best interest in mind, whether on a global, local, or national level. We will invest your membership dollars right back into the news and programs that you expect from us. So thanks to you for making the campaign such a fabulous success. Thanks.
I'm George Takei. In 1938, families gathered in front of the radio at night.
Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the air in The War of the Worlds.
The War of the Worlds is the most famous radio broadcast of all time.
We take you now to Grover's Mill, New Jersey.
And we're bringing it back for its 75th birthday.
tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, again talking with David Sanger. He's the New York Times chief Washington correspondent about some of the fallout from government surveillance. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. David, I've in my travels putting shows together, I've seen the NSA referred to as no such agency, as it's kind of a nickname, NSA. Who does it answer to? Who provides the oversight? And I ask that because Senator Dianne Feinstein is pretty angry, feeling that Congress has been left out of I guess, their responsibility.
She has. Look, the National Security Agency is one of the largest of the 16 American intelligence agencies. The other big ones, obviously, are the Defense Intelligence Agency and the CIA. It's certainly one of the most powerful, and it's particularly powerful because the head of the National Security Agency is also the head of U.S. Cyber Command, which is the new military side of cyber offense and cyber defense. So it's an extraordinarily powerful, extraordinarily large agency that got its start in the cracking of codes in the World War II. You know, their origins are enigma, the cracking of the German codes. They report, as all of the intelligence agencies do, into the Director of National Intelligence, a post that was created post 9/11 as part of the reforms about what went wrong in intelligence sharing in the days leading up to, days, months, and years leading up to 9/11. So that person is James Clapper, the DNI, they then report, DNI then reports directly to the president. So that's where they fit in. All of these agencies regularly brief Congress, regularly brief Dianne Feinstein, who's the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee. And so her anger, it's interesting because she's been extremely supportive of most surveillance programs, including the NSA's domestic collection of bulk metadata about your phone calls. So that statement that she issued on Monday night was unusual, extremely. And it indicated that she felt that she had not been properly briefed on this. Now, the agencies say, look, it's pretty clear we've been monitoring foreign leaders for many, many decades. So what is her surprise?
Well, do you think she's getting, and I know you have to leave us in about 4 or 5 minutes or so, but do you think she's getting pressure from the public? And is it's sometimes hard to read whether there's public outrage on this or not, and we've been focusing largely on what's been going on in Europe. But do you think she was getting pressure from the people?
That was not my read of it. I mean, first of all, she's an extremely safe, secure spot as a senator from California. Of course, former mayor of San Francisco. I think American outrage tends to be more focused on domestic spying, just as in the German outrage is about spying there. I don't think you're seeing a whole lot of public pressure in the United States about why the U.S. is monitoring Chancellor Merkel or any other leader. But she does tend to want to protect the privileges, oversight privileges, of the Senate Intelligence Committee. And that committee is set up precisely to do oversight of foreign intelligence operations.
I noticed that Clapper said, be careful not to, quote, overcorrect authorizations of the intelligence community, saying, you know, don't push back too hard on us.
Right. And so, you know, in the intelligence community, the sort of defining political event were the Church Committee hearings of three decades ago, which led to a number of major intelligence reforms. But there is fear in the intelligence community that turning on and off their powers ends up leading to mistakes that can result in 9/11s. Because, look, they are there to protect against the small likelihood, extremely high casualty event, an attack on the United States. Mm-hmm. And I saw General Alexander earlier this month, and he said, look, since 9/11, there have been, I think he said, I could have my numbers wrong here, two Americans killed by terrorists on American soil. And he said, that is no accident. And so they feel very much that if their hands are tied, the things that they have done to try to prevent a repeat of 9/11 would be impeded. And so it's a very difficult balancing act.
Final question. How do you, or what do you make of Edward Snowden's, you know, leaks and the reporting based on his leaks? Has that been a public service to us?
Well, I don't think that Edward Snowden is most people's definition of a hero. He had signed a series of commitments to keep this kind of information secret, and he clearly, by his own admission, violated that. And I imagine at some point, if he leaves Russia and comes back into American hands, he's going to have to deal with the outflow from that. That said, I think some of the revelations he's made, not all, but some of them have done a public service because they have started a debate about whether or not there is overreach in these agencies that would not have happened in the absence of these disclosures. You know, President Obama has now stepped in and said, we don't have the balance right and we've got to go fix this. And he obviously is moving toward a ban on the kind of monitoring of allied foreign leaders, not all, but some, and leaning towards some other reforms. I doubt that would happen. Mm. I doubt it would have happened if it hadn't been for the Snowden revelations.
Well, on that note, David Sanger, thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Great to be with you.
And he's a chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times. And again, his book, Confront and Conceal, Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power, just out in paperback. Well, after 9/11, the government's authority to collect information on American citizens was greatly expanded. As a result, huge amounts of data exist on law-abiding citizens. Joining us now is Rachel Levinson Waldman, and she serves as counsel to the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program, author of a new report titled What the Government Does with Americans' Data. And Rachel Levinson Waldman, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
So thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. You can send us an email. Go to radiotimes@whyy.org. I was just talking with David Sanger about the mining, I guess, of European phone calls, including European leaders. When we talk about data mining in the United States, what are we talking about?
Well, when we're talking about data mining in the United States, there are a couple of different things that we could be talking about. You know, data mining itself, there are a couple of different kinds of data mining. There could be starting with a particular person's information and kind of walking through data to find other contacts, to find a co-conspirator, things like that. Mm-hmm. Or there could be what we talk about as pattern-based data mining, which is kind of trying to unearth patterns from a big mass of information. Right now, there are a variety of kinds of information, a variety of kinds of data that are gathered on Americans. When we're thinking about the NSA context, there's metadata about phone calls. There's content of some emails and phone calls. We've learned recently that information about American social network connections could be getting collected. I think one of the most interesting sort of data mining stories recently is the revelation that in 2011 the NSA got permission to start walking through American social networks in a way that they hadn't had the ability to do before.
And who besides the NSA? I mean, so much of the focus is on the NSA, but from your report, there are other agencies that are also involved in some of this work.
Absolutely. So when you're thinking about the collection and retention of non-criminal information on Americans, there are a host of agencies involved. So as you say, the NSA, the FBI also is one of the biggest players, especially post 9/11. Their authority expanded in a variety of ways to gather and then especially to keep information that turns out not to be related to criminal activity, not to form the basis for a criminal investigation. Much of that information is kept for decades anyway in case it's important in the future. The Department of Homeland Security as well, especially because of its interactions with travel, with international travel, also has the ability to gather and often keep a fair amount of information on Americans that, again, wouldn't be criminally related.
And this is different from eavesdropping. I mean, literally listening in on, let's say, a phone conversation. I'm assuming you still need a warrant for that. Do I have that right?
That's right. So if you're talking about listening in on an American, the government needs a warrant. So in the criminal context, it would be what we think of as a typical criminal warrant. In the national security context, it's a specialized warrant. But that's right. To intentionally target an American and to actually listen in on the content of a phone conversation or kind of quote-unquote listen in on an email, you would need a warrant. What we're talking about here is a variety of things. So in the context of the NSA, either it's gathering information about communications or it's what's called incidental communication. In the context of targeting a foreigner, they also get a lot of information about Americans. With the FBI, it's in the context of the investigations that they can do. There are these very low-level investigations that the FBI can do. They can serve certain kinds of subpoenas. As a result of opening investigation, they can plant an informant. They can engage in physical surveillance. They can attend meetings undercover. And all of the information that's gathered through those processes can then be kept in FBI files.
But would it be fair to say that information on what, all of us? I mean, most of us are innocent Americans, that information on all of us is stored somewhere by the U.S. government?
You know, I think it depends. You know, I don't think that we're in a situation where we can say, you know, we're living in a police state. You know, every person's movements are monitored all the time. I do think it's safe to say, certainly we know that the NSA has gathered information about just about every American's phone call. So it's a pretty sure bet that if you have made a phone call in this country, whether it's a domestic phone call or an international phone call, information about that call is living in an NSA database, at least for some period of time. For some of these other collection authorities, you know, if you've traveled internationally, if you've gone through a border, there's certainly some information that's kept from that. In terms of FBI work, it depends to some extent, you know, have you had some relation to, have you been connected in some way to somebody who was the target of an investigation? Potentially, have you been involved in political activities that the FBI has decided to target?
But we're talking, I guess, about billions and billions, maybe even, I don't even know, trillions of bits of information. How does a government or any government agency sift through that looking for a potential terrorist or potential criminal activity?
Well, I think this is one of the real problems, and this is one of the things that's been coming out more and more, really, across agencies. We have experts from the NSA most recently, from the Department of Defense, from the CIA, from the Department of Homeland Security, all saying that there is too much information coming into the system, and that one of the consequences of gathering so much information isn't so much that you have this incredibly rich database that you can, you know, pull anything you need from, but that, in fact, it gets in the way of analysis. And we've seen reviews of things like the underwear bomber, which was, you know, as we know, almost successful, right, of the shootings at Fort Hood. And the official reviews of those have said that one of the elements that got in the way of anticipating and stopping those attacks was that there was too much information in the system, not that there wasn't enough.
But does that mean, are there calls even within the NSA and perhaps other intelligence agencies to rethink this meta-gathering?
I mean, certainly from what we've seen publicly from the NSA, they seem to be holding pretty fast to their line that what they're doing is necessary. Certainly some evidence to the contrary. Whether there's calls within other agencies, you know, so far it's been kind of individual officials who have said, this is really a problem, we're taking in more than we can handle. I'm not sure that we've seen yet an agency sort of institutionally say, we need to seriously change what we're doing and really cut down on what we're collecting.
Let me get some callers in our conversation at 1-888-477-9499. Looks like we have John from Collingswood joining us on Radio Times. John, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, yes. Thanks very much. Forgive me. I'll bring this down.
Sure.
I was in the middle of researching yet specifics on this, so again, I apologize. But as I recall, about a year ago, Keith Alexander demonstrably misled I believe it was two senators, one Washington State, Oregon, forgive me for being so imprecise, but without question, he stated, well, we don't have the capacity to record the kind of data you're looking for. Well, of course, it later turned out he did indeed, and this is independent.
Yeah, well, and that's something we talked about at the beginning of the hour. John, can you ask your question?
Oh, yeah, forgive me. Okay.
That's okay.
Also, the Electronic Freedom Foundation had a representative who reviewed metadata indicating that, in fact, it can be far more revealing than taping, as it were, digitally capturing conversations and identifying people, because it's so comprehensive and is much more intrusive than people realize.
No, it's a great point, and I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Rachel, he's saying that, you know, this metadating can perhaps be more revealing than listening in on a phone conversation. Is he right about that, do you think?
I think that's absolutely right, and that's been one of the most, in some ways, frustrating aspects about the last couple of months, is that, of course, the very first revelation that came out from the Snowden disclosures was that there was this database of metadata about American phone calls. So, you know, when you place a call, whom it's to, how long it lasts. And a consistent talking point for the last 4 to 5 months from the government has basically been, don't worry, there's nothing to see here. We're not taping your phone calls. And expert after expert has said, it may be that they're not taping phone calls, but absolutely this information is so revealing. You can really map somebody's networks, their connections. You can draw inferences. They may be correct or incorrect, but you can draw a lot of inferences depending on who somebody calls, who they call next, whom they talk to for how long. And presumably that's one of the reasons also that the NSA is fighting so hard to keep this information and to keep this database, is precisely because they consider it to be so revealing.
I mean, does it look like our phone bill, and by that I mean there's a phone number. I haven't looked at a phone bill in a while, I have to admit that. But, you know, the duration of the phone call, things like that, is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, so we're talking about, right, the basics that would be reflected. You know, if you looked at your own phone bill, and if you looked at maybe a friend's phone bill, you know, what you would see, you know, is sort of a series of numbers and calls. But armed with kind of vast amounts of that information and also the ability to drill down, you know, whom does a particular phone number represent, things like that, there are then a lot of inferences, a lot of conclusions that can be drawn from that information, sort of armed with those analytical tools.
And that's Rachel Levinson-Waldman. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Now, we're talking about a new report that she just wrote called What the Government Does with Americans' Data. And she serves as a counsel to the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program. And I'm sure you have been following, heard about, read about the NSA and other government agencies' data mining. What do you think of that? Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
The Executive Doctorate of Business Administration at Temple University's Fox School of Business supports WHYY. This 3-year applied research-focused degree is designed to provide experienced business leaders the skills to address tomorrow's challenges. Executive DBA students receive faculty mentorship, online collaboration, and the Fox School's reputation for high-quality research. Temple University Fox School of Business. Discover the power of Fox. Learn more at fox.temple.edu/executive-dba.
The housing guy who sounds like an environmentalist.
The 12 hottest years we've ever had in our history have happened in the last 15. This is not just an anomaly. We have to prepare our communities for these storms again.
HUD Secretary Sean Donovan on why weather and climate make his job harder. More earthly challenges next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Rachmaninoff dedicated his symphonic dances to the Philadelphia Orchestra. Yannick Nézet-Séguin and the orchestra perform the symphonic dances with new works for the orchestra's principal players from composers of our day. Tickets at 215-893-1999 or online. this Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at the Kimmel Center. Rachmaninoff with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Motz-Cohen. Reading from Rachel Levinson Waldman's report, What the Government Does with Americans' Data, if the NSA has incidentally acquired Americans' communications as part of its targeting of non-Americans, then the NSA may retain the records for up to 6 years. And again, Rachel Levinson Waldman, counsel to the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program, and we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Rachel, does that change the sort of reasonable suspicion standard that if the information is being held with the thought that perhaps at some future date we might break the law or do something bad, then they have the information on us?
Yeah, so this is troubling. I think we should make a little bit of a distinction between the reasons for which the NSA keeps information and the reasons for which the FBI keeps information. The FBI very much says, we basically keep anything we gather in case it's useful in the future, including potentially a crime or some threat that arises in the future. The NSA says that it can hold on to the information that it gathers for up to 6 years from the start of surveillance to determine whether that information about Americans either contains useful foreign intelligence information or evidence of a crime. So they don't necessarily seem to be holding on to information in case it is related to a future crime. It looks as though it would need to be evidence of a current crime, but one of the troubling things is that there doesn't seem to be much of a standard about how serious that crime would be, what would be involved. And then there's the additional piece, as you were talking about, the notion of reasonable suspicion. You know, usually in this country, the idea isn't that you get to collect lots of information and then just sift through it to see if there's evidence of a crime, that there does have to be some standard, traditional law enforcement standards, for getting that information in the first place. And this looks like an end run around those standards.
Is that your concern, that this information could be misused?
Yeah, so it's certainly partly a concern about misuse, and that's sort of, you know, that's the history that we know. Starting in the 50s, 60s, 70s, you see the reports coming out of the Church Committee that across the spectrum, the FBI, the CIA, the NSA, were involved in massive domestic spying operations that turned into very serious abuse, misuse of personal information, targeting political enemies, targeting minority groups, things like that. But then also simply the basics that there are standards for how criminal investigations are started, how criminal information is collected. Those standards are lower in the intelligence context, which is what the NSA is working with. So the idea that information could be collected using these lower intelligence standards but then used in a criminal context sort of creates a backdoor in some ways for law enforcement agencies.
We have an email from Peter from Wyomissing. He wants to know, do people have a right to FOIA, a Freedom of Information Act, for their metadata or other data that's been tracked on them? Do you know the answer to that, Rachel?
That's a good question. So if people were trying to obtain their own information, technically it would be through the Privacy Act, which was passed basically right around the time that the Church Committee report was coming out in the mid-1970s. And it imposes certain protections on Americans' data, and it allows people to, in theory, find out what information is held about them in a federal agency to challenge the accuracy of the information. There are really significant loopholes to the Privacy Act, and they include databases that relate to national security, to law enforcement. There are increasingly whole databases that simply aren't covered by the Privacy Act for a variety of reasons. So, you know, by the letter of the statute, certainly somebody could file a Privacy Act request. When you're talking about these kinds of sensitive databases, it is extraordinarily unlikely that anybody would actually get any useful information back.
I think it's interesting that Senator Leahy, from a Democrat from Vermont, and Congressman Sensenbrenner, a Republican from Wisconsin, have introduced a bill that is aimed at, and I'm quoting here from NPR, aimed at the bulk collection of telephone records by the NSA, the idea that it would focus on surveillance programs that sweep up data from ordinary Americans. not sure where this bill would go, but does that, do you think, in certain ways express some of the concerns coming from members of Congress?
Yeah, absolutely. This bill that was introduced, it's a bipartisan bill. It's getting huge support in the House. It's getting support in the Senate. And I think it really reflects both the public and Congress's frustration over what it's learning, the scope of the surveillance activities that it's learning about. And as you were talking about in the first half, the feeling that the intelligence community hasn't been fully upfront or candid about the scope of that surveillance.
That Edward Snowden knew more than they did.
Yes, effectively. That's right.
Let me get to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get, looks like Richard from Westchester to join our conversation. And Richard, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I was wondering if there's any way we can determine what kind of money is being spent on all this information gathering, or is this covered by the black budget since it's surveillance, since it's secretive?
Really?
And also, what kind of numbers of people are involved in creating this this class of people that are spying on the rest of us?
Richard, let me see what Rachel Levinson Wolman has to say. Rachel, can you respond to that?
It's a good question. I don't have specific numbers at my fingertips. It would be covered by the black budget, and that, as I think Richard was referring to, is basically the budget for the intelligence community. It has often been entirely undisclosed. There was some information that was disclosed this year, I believe a combination of some classified information that came out and also perhaps some information that was declassified. The numbers are still very high level, so you might find about, you know, the amount that an agency is spending, but it's generally not for public consumption, divided into particular programs. Certainly we know that the intelligence community gets, I believe, billions of dollars a year in federal funding. I think it's safe to say that there is a lot of money flowing into these programs and a lot of people involved, both employees and contractors. And I think one of the things that that does is raise the question, for all of this money, for all of these resources, what are we getting back? And that makes it especially troubling that we're learning that some of these programs contribute little to nothing to our counterterrorism efforts.
Richard, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And again, you can call 1-888-477-9499. And you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Let me see what Matt from, looks like Blackwood, New Jersey, has to say. Matt, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for having me. It's kind of a vague question. Pretty much, I was just wondering if there had ever been any polls, maybe just after 9/11 or in the recent years with all the Snowden reports, whether or not most Americans actually agree that spying on have any support for the system of spying on ourselves and not only our allies, but our own phone calls. Do we agree with it? Because I can't help but think of Benjamin Franklin saying, you know, he who would trade liberty for our security for liberty deserves neither. So I was wondering if maybe there's any insight on that.
Sure, Matt. Thanks for the call. Rachel, I mean, there has been some polling on this.
Yeah, absolutely. Since 9/11, there's been a lot of polling on Americans' feelings about, you know, spying, sort of civil liberties issues generally, counterterrorism issues generally. I know that in July of this year, there was a poll from Pew, which is a pretty well-respected organization. So this was in July of 2013, noting that for the first time since Pew first asked the question in 2004, that a response from the public had been in favor of civil liberties over protection from terrorism. So even as late as 2010, 47% of the public, as against 32%, believed protection against terrorism didn't go far enough. In the middle of the summer, 47%, as against 35%, believe that restricting civil liberties goes too far. So I think that you are seeing a shift in public opinion. I think kind of a combination of the distance from 9/11 and then what these revelations are showing us, both about the scope of domestic surveillance and in a lot of cases, the pretty minimal value that we're getting from the program.
And it really was the Patriot Act that has authorized this surveillance.
So it's a combination. The Patriot Act was a major piece that lowered the standards for a lot of spying. And then there were amendments to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. In 2007, 2008, FISA was amended in large part to sort of codify what a lot of your listeners might remember as the warrantless wiretapping scandal. And in 2008, the law was changed basically to say what's been happening illegally can, in a lot of ways, happen legally. There were some additional there's some additional oversight that was imposed in terms of some court involvement, which is its own separate issue. But between the Patriot Act and the FISA Amendments Act, those both radically expanded the scope of surveillance.
Looking at your report, and you raised questions about the NSA, other agencies, you know, holding this information and possibly sharing this information, but you even raised questions about sharing it with, quote, private parties. What's a private party?
Well, so a private party could be, for instance, the FBI and fusion centers especially, so sort of these partnerships of local, state, federal law enforcement, often have close relationships to corporations, to companies who, you know, are interested in protection of their physical property, who may, you know, have an eye on cyber spying or cyber attacks. And so there are often partnerships with those kinds of private companies. And so some, you know, we don't know, unfortunately, many of the details of the sharing. Those are often in, you know, secret memorandum of understanding. But what I'd anticipate is that it would be with the kinds of companies that are kind of working with law enforcement in other circumstances, that there might be certain sharing that goes to them.
I mean, for commercial purposes or something else, or more about protecting their data?
Well, I think those two go together. I mean, one of the interesting things, I believe this is in the what are called the minimization procedures for data about Americans that the NSA collects, and I believe you see this also in the FBI's policies, that information can be shared if there's a danger of, there's sort of a threat to life or property. And so you have to think, they're probably not that concerned about an individual's property. You're probably talking here about corporate property, whether that's cyber property or physical. You know, maybe in the case of, you know, some planned, you know, an event that's planned, something like that.
Sarah from Philadelphia sent us an email. What is the possibility that this spying will ever stop? Can all of that data ever be destroyed?
It's a really important question, and I think it's critical the way she articulated that there are two separate pieces of it. So the first is, will this spying ever stop? Certainly, foreign intelligence work isn't going to stop. We hope that there are going to be substantial limits imposed on the extent to which Americans' data, especially innocent Americans' data, is collected, the extent to which it's kept once it's determined not to have any relationship to criminal matters, to foreign intelligence matters. But then the separate question that she asked, whether this data is ever all going to be destroyed, I think that's one of the real dangers here. That's once information is brought in and once it's retained in databases, it seems extremely unlikely that there's going to be sort of a systematic effort to delete it. And one of the things that we found out, that we know, is that once information is in one database, it often kind of hops to other databases, and so chasing down where that information has gone can be extraordinarily difficult, if not impossible.
How much do you think, though, this is technology-driven, which is that we have the technology to do this, so we're going to put it into effect, and that we can't not do it because we have the technology?
I think it's to some extent technology-driven and to some extent technology facilitated. So thinking again about what we learned in the 60s and 70s about what the agencies had been doing, the fact that they didn't have the technology that we have now certainly didn't stop them from undertaking very significant domestic spying initiatives. So I don't think it's just that technology sort of is the, you know, is the ground point for this. That being said, absolutely, technology makes this easier. It makes it easier to gather the information. It makes it easier to keep the information because it's digital instead of being on, you know, index cards. And we have just incredible quantities of digital storage now. It is just much easier and much cheaper to keep this information. And at the same time, what I think is very tempting for the agencies and concerning for us is how easy it is to analyze it, to draw connections. Those connections might be correct or incorrect, but that there are so many analytical tools that can be applied that I think that becomes very tempting.
About a minute before we have to say goodbye here, and you referenced some polling about how Americans feel about this, but Americans, as we know, myself included, I mean, we use the internet and we give away information about ourselves all the time if you're shopping online, for instance.
Sure. Yeah, and I think the distinction there, it's a couple of things. It's partly how are you choosing to use your own information. I think it would be ridiculous to suggest that the only way people have to protect themselves is to stop using the internet, stop using smartphones. This is how people interact. It's how commerce works. It's how social connections work. It's about you making the choices about how you use that information and how you share it. And frankly, there's a major difference between corporations having that information and the government having it. Increasingly, it's very easy for the government to get that information from corporations. But the power of prosecution and the power of surveillance that the government has puts it in a whole different class.
Well, on that note, my thanks to you, Rachel Levinson-Waldman, for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And again, she's counsel to the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program, author of this new report titled What the Government Does with Americans' Data. And we began our conversation with David Sanger. He's a chief Washington correspondent for The New York Times. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to learn much more about this program, including a Facebook, Twitter, podcast. It's all there. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.